An evening of lively, smart conversation and jazz. Join me, John Williams, for a live taping of the Mincing Rascals podcast, Robert's Pizza, and Jazz, Wednesday, June 12th, 6 to 8 at Winter's Jazz Club in Streeterville. Tickets at WGNRadio.com/rascals. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. Today is March 13th, 2024. It's 2:40 in the afternoon, and hello again. It's John Williams, and welcome to the Rascals Pod. Share us with your friends. Send us an email. I'll read at least one of the correspondents that have come in to the Mincing Rascals, John Williams at WGNRadio.com, towards the end of our pod. We'd like to hear from you. If you've got complaints, suggestions, or praise, you can email John Williams at WGNRadio.com. And listen for me weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
I'm Marge Halperin. I'm a veteran in state and local politics, a communications consultant, former Democratic strategist for WGN-TV Morning News. And you can hear my commentary now on Canada's CTV as well as this podcast.
Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, columnist, now writing the Chicago history website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
I'm Eric Zorn, the Picayune Sentinel editor and proprietor, I'm a weekly Substack newsletter, former Tribune columnist, and I wish I had a resume as long as Marge Halperin's. Man, you're on Canadian
Canada's
radio now?
CTV.
Yeah, it's a national news network.
So, in what capacity are you working for them?
As a Democratic analyst, so like on the night of the State of the Union address, giving them my view from the left.
Canada's sufficiently interested in America that they're asking you to comment on American politics.
Yeah, and they know a lot about it, as you would think.
Oh, I sometimes think people in England and Canada and France and Germany know more about our politics sometimes than we do.
Oh, I'm always shocked at how many Canadian people are talking heads on the various, you know, cable news stations, and they seem to know everything about our history and our local politics. How do they have time?
I once did a New Zealand radio piece, and they said, don't talk down to our audience. They know everything about American politics.
Huh. I don't think I could name the Prime Minister of Canada off the top of my head.
This Trudeau.
Who?
Trudeau.
Oh, it's still Trudeau? Okay, fine.
It's still.
Right. I mean, it seems like not a particularly relevant piece of information.
I remember this awful Onion headline. Perky Canada has their own laws. They do, and their own prime minister, too.
But, you know, it's funny because when Brenda and I travel a little bit, we'll be somewhere outside the United States, and not only do I not know any of the politics there or the politicians, but then they know who my congressman is or what Bernie Sanders said yesterday. And I'm like, wow, it's bad enough you guys speak two or three languages, but you know our stuff better than we do sometimes.
Well, and certainly one of the best political commentators on the American scene is John Oliver.
I mean, whose English is very good. But do you think, you know, and I feel a little insecure about how international we aren't and how we are speak just English and sometimes not very well. If we were Europe, you and I would probably be fluent in Indiana and Wisconsin, and we would know a little Iowa, right? I mean, just because you would have to. So maybe it's not that they're all that in a bag of chips, but rather that they just, out of necessity, have to learn about other governments, countries, and languages. If they were here, they would sound like people from Peoria.
That's maybe a little bit of the U.S. ego, isn't it, though?
Or they insecurity.
They have to know about us. You don't have to know about them.
Speaking of us, who knew that a State of the Union speech could be upstaged by the other party's response, if only for comedic purposes anyway. But before we get to Alabama Senator Katie Britt's response to Joe Biden's speech, let's talk about his content and delivery. I have said before that I'm sorry he's running again, and his age and communication abilities are such a liability, fairly or not, that his vanity could cost him the election and put Donald Trump back in the White House. But as for that speech, I thought he was terrific. Granted, it was a campaign speech. I was rather startled by how much a campaign speech it was, as opposed to whatever a State of the Union address would be. But that was a good one. His optics and his points were strong. Marge, do you agree with me on all that?
I do. There was a Colbert ran a a series of quick cuts of just him yelling, you know, bring it on, or I won't let it happen, and we're going to stop it right now. He's, you know, and when you cut them all together, you're like, whoa, I want that guy working for me. It was the energy was good. He made one ad lib error, with more than an error, really unfortunate. I think his interaction with Marjorie Taylor Greene about the woman who was killed by an undocumented person, he used the noun illegal, which I felt kind of an old man mistake. He wasn't up on the lingo the way he should have been, but also engaging with her, it, you know, I'll say her name. Let's say her name is a Black Lives Matter chant related to women who were murdered by police officers. For him to repeat that phrase and help the GOP MAGAites co-opt it, I just thought was a really sour note. Not overwhelming all the great stuff. And I'm excited that he recited his accomplishments and reminded everybody about the gun reform law and the climate change and the other things that he's doing, the loan forgiveness that the progressives want him to do. Just that one moment was a little bit of a raw note.
Well, I'm going to be a big wet blanket about this. You know, he got through it without any terrible, terrible mistakes. There were a couple of awkward things like the one that Marge just mentioned, and the part where he included Moscow as a good place to go for cheap prescription drugs for Americans.
Might be. We don't
but,
know.
Okay. I think it's a big mistake for Democrats or anyone hoping for Donald Trump to not get elected to be too excited about it. It's a very, very low bar that he was able to get through this speech with some energy. I don't know about you guys, but I was definitely kind of, you know, almost like I was afraid to fly, you know, like clutching the armrest the whole time.
Yeah, but he landed the plane, though. But didn't he land the plane? Like, he can only do so much with a speech.
He landed the plane just barely. If you're fair, there was plenty of kind of slurred speech here and there. And
was it the content or the delivery then? Because, for instance, he got her name wrong.
I don't have any big problem with the content itself. But the basic strategy that he has chosen, that his people have chosen, for him to be Mr. Feisty, Mr., you know, angry grandpa, it can only go so far. He did that in the last election. I mean, he did that very memorably to me. Every time I saw him at a campaign stop, when he would get asked an awkward question that he wasn't ready for, his go-to thing, instead of trying to answer it, was to just get mad. And that gets people off his back. But you can't just be mad constantly.
Was it the tone? You would have preferred him to ratchet it down a little bit?
I don't think the feisty thing can take him very far. I was reading Nate Silver's look at it, and he made the point, the kind of little approval bump that presidents will get from a State of the Union speech never lasts very long. The approval rating that Biden got from this one was actually the lowest since 1998.
Focus groups or something? Is that because they can't have had full field polls out in the field already about the...
Who do they actually poll? I don't know. You'd have to ask Nate Silver.
That's even fine. If it was a bigger number, it's a bump. And I think the question is, can he repeat this? Can he stay on topic?
Yeah,
can he stay
point.
Energetic? Can he sort of dismiss some of the concerns about his ability or his age or whatever?
If the poll doesn't jump ahead, is that because of his delivery? Or is it because we're so polarized, most people have made up their minds?
My point is, let's, you know, people who don't want Trump to be president, I don't think should get too excited because Joe Biden managed to basically get through a speech.
Okay, wait. I want to hear what Eric has to say about this, but he didn't walk it backwards, right? Kate, at least he didn't harm
his
campaign.
Definitely did not go backwards.
If you don't share Marge's enthusiasm or mine that he actually did himself a real solid there, at least he didn't shoot himself in the foot, the very low bar.
I totally agree.
It's so funny that we're talking about you know, the Biden's delivery, whether he can advance himself, while you've got Donald Trump hosting Viktor Orban down at Mar-a-Lago and praising this fascist dictator. And everyone just goes, oh, that's Donald Trump. I mean, it's like it's so much is baked into this. I think that Biden did reset the narrative on that he's too old to be president. I thought he came out strong. Kate thought too strong. But I thought that that strength was important. David Axelrod on his podcast this week was recalling an expression that Bill Clinton used to use, which in politics, being strong and wrong is better than being weak and right. And Donald Trump's main attribute is that he appears strong. I mean, yeah, he's just a few years younger than Biden, but he has this large presence. And even though he fumbles his words and says kooky things, he still projects the image of strength. And I think that Biden's speech did something to remind people that he too is a strong leader. He too can be strong. I want to push back a little bit on this idea that him using the term illegals was this thing that required this major kerfuffle. He's 81 years old. Illegal aliens was a term that we used for decades, and it was just commonly used. And then we finally realized that then the word went out that people aren't illegal, that they're here they're undocumented. I mean, it's sort of a fine semantic point. I get it. But I also think that making a big deal about it and then Biden apologizing, which the Republicans then turned around to saying that he is apologizing to Laken Riley's alleged killer, which is, of course, how they would spin it. It just fed into this narrative. And I think some great middle mass of voters thinks that the Democrats are too obsessed with terminology and pronouns and things like that aren't real kitchen table issues, and that this obsession, they call it woke, politically correct, and so on. And I feel like that focusing on that for Chuy Garcia to come out and scold the president over this, it's like, you know, just not now. I mean, so I wanted to say to these guys, like, not now. You guys, you know, corner him quietly in the White House and say, President Biden, it's the thing we this is not how what we say anymore. But I just was like, I was like, because stepping on the fact that I thought he gave a good speech. I think he changed the narrative to a point that the campaign really started last week. I mean, we got him now, right? He clinched the nomination this week. So he's the nominee. Unless he decides to step aside for some reason or another, we're going to have a rematch. And so we those of us who are aghast at the idea of Trump being reelected, need to get energized, need to get Joe Biden's voters out there, need to allay their fears and about Biden's mental capacity, about his age, and champion this guy who has been a pretty darn effective president, whether he can remember certain dates or not.
Woke, by the way, being another term stolen from the Black Lives Matter movement. Right. To your point, though, about the comparison, this is the problem, right? That because we don't expect Trump to be articulate or even very smart, although he's proven to be smart in some ways that are hurting us on the left, but we don't expect that of him, so we don't make a big deal out of it. Biden presents himself as smarter, more in control. We expect him to perform at a higher level than Trump. How fair is that? I don't know. I could credit a version of what you said to my sister, who says she'd rather vote for someone who forgets a few things than someone who remembers Hitler fondly.
I don't think it's fair to say, though, that we don't expect as much from Trump. The point is that Trump voters don't expect much from
Yes.
Trump. The people who are against Trump, we all are aghast and talk about these things. And these things that he does get plenty of press coverage. But the point is his voters don't care.
No.
So if you don't want him to get elected, there's really no point in focusing on that, because it just doesn't matter to his voters.
That's right. They say he could be a dictator. You've seen those clips.
Yeah.
You know, Jordan Klepper, whoever goes out and interviews people.
Oh,
if he wants to be a dictator, I'm cool.
Do you think that Joe Biden's speech, I described it as a campaign speech as opposed to a State of the Union address, the idea being that here's the State of the Union, you reach across the aisle, you talk about the accomplishments, but you don't just criticize your quote-unquote predecessor. I was right away taken aback by how much a stump speech it felt. And then with the cheering of the Democrats in the crowd, they were really feeling this speech for him. They were trying to help him rather than just agree with him. I think it's a fair criticism to say that when you stand there before justices of the Supreme Court, the top military, the Democrats and the Republicans, and you just criticize your opponent, that's not a State of the Union address.
I think that's too generalized a summary of what he was doing. He went through the accomplishment so far. He outlined his plan for the future, the things that he would do, the things that he would not let Republicans do, despite some of their desires to cut entitlements or do other things. And, you know, and I think that is pretty typical for the last State of the Union in a term. That's what's required. And in the, you know, the environment is not what it used to be. So I think he needed to do what he did, knowing that he would be jeered the way he was, that he would have to address Supreme Court members who have seemed to have their own bias. I'd throw that out from your summary because they didn't even all show up.
There's a pretty good question in my mind about whether this tradition has now worn itself out. You have this State of the Union speech, which has become highly political. Both sides, you know, there's the really blatant cheering and booing and catcalling now that seems to be taking place as a regular feature. Remember, we were aghast when someone yelled, "You lie," at President Obama. What was that, like 10 years ago? And now all of a sudden, it just seems to be like part of the bumptious atmosphere at these speeches. There's no requirement in the Constitution that the president give the speech live, right, or all he has to do is report in the State of the Union. He could issue a written statement. He could do a speech from the Oval Office. The entire ceremony is inviting trouble in an environment that's just as polarized as it is. So, you know, I could do without it myself. It was a campaign speech, you're right, but I think it's been a campaign speech for a long time, especially in campaign years. I mean, it won't be next year probably, but it's always going to be during the quadrennial election.
I don't know who wants to be the first president to buck this trend. Maybe a dictator would.
The dictators love to give those long speeches, like Castro, right? And doesn't Putin give speeches that are hours and hours long? And
oh yeah, so, but Trump would only do it in his own office when he could retake whatever he wanted.
Which is not what the senator from Alabama, Katie Britt, did. That was a live performance by her in the State of the Union response from the Republicans. I'm not steeped enough in national politics to have known that the junior senator from Alabama was Katie Britt. When the speech was over, she came on and she was saying Joe Biden is bad and he doesn't get it. And I thought, I'm done with this, and I turned it off. I really missed a show. And good Lord, was that fodder for Saturday Night Live.
The Republican response was delivered by Alabama Senator Katie Britt, who made some choices.
As a mom, I can't quit thinking about this. Mr. President, enough is enough. We see you. We hear you. And we stand with you.
Thanks.
Jimmy Kimmel at the Oscars.
So unbelievably great and poor things. Emma played an adult woman with the brain of a child, like the lady who gave the rebuttal to the State of the Union on Thursday.
Can I just say real quick that, as I believe I mentioned to you guys earlier, I do find it just a little sexist for people to be making a big deal about the fact that she was talking from her kitchen. What's wrong with that? I talked to you guys from the kitchen. We got addicted to MSNBC over COVID. And when everybody was phoning it in, even the people who were their on-air personalities, I'm going to say like 75% of them zoomed in for their appearances from their kitchen, such that there was a Twitter account comparing people's kitchens. And me and my husband were always talking about, oh, did you see so-and-so's kitchen? Oh, how about this?
It looks like Kate's got a vintage Mixmaster there in the background.
See? Oh, that is a nice Mixmaster.
You do. And that would have been the point. You know, you obviously have a working kitchen. She had a staged kitchen, sanitized for this phony setup of America's mom. I don't know who thinks she looks like America.
It was cleaned up, and that's for sure.
On paper, I thought it was a good idea. I mean, in a way, we're relating to American families, and here's a mom who's also a senator, and we all do spend a lot of time in our kitchen. That's the focal point of homes. So I get it, although Scarlett Johansson made fun of that, saying moms like kitchen.
Sure. I'm a wife, a mother, and the craziest in the Target parking lot. Worried about the future of our children, and this is why I've invited you into this strange empty kitchen. Because Republicans wanted me to appeal to woman voters, and women love kitchen.
Staging notwithstanding, what else about that was good or bad?
Well, I know Marge has some ideas on that.
I do, as in my op-ed in the Tribune today, Wednesday. I was outraged by her focus on the sex trafficking victim from Mexico. As soon as she started speaking about it, I was yelling at my TV, didn't happen in the U.S., that she's a Mexican woman, but I didn't know the whole background. It took an independent reporter, Jonathan Katz, I believe is his name, who researched it and found easily that this is a woman who's testified publicly at a House committee hearing that Britt attended, as did others, and it was probably recorded on C-SPAN in public, about instances that happened, brutal and horrific things that happened to her in the early 2000s when Biden wasn't even vice president. George Bush was president. It happened in Mexico under a Republican president who I wouldn't blame for it either because it happened in Mexico. But she said it was U.S. in her phrasing. I know they edited it carefully, but that's what she said. Well, and then she used it, and this is the really offensive part to me. She used it as a way to continue the fear-mongering about people who come here for asylum. Well, I believe that sexual trafficking victims from Mexico should be welcomed here. That's what asylum is for. And then I'll take it one step further. She twists this woman's story of being abused in Mexico in order to make American women afraid of migrants who come here for asylum, and then make them so afraid they're going to vote for a guy who is a convicted sexual predator. The horror of that just needs to be shouted from the rooftops. Cynicism, I don't know what to call it. It's a lie. It's flat out lying, but it's disgusting.
Her campaign issued a statement saying everything she said was true.
Well, if you parse the sentences.
Yeah, so she said, I'm going to parse them now. She said, we would not be okay with this happening in a third world country. The inference being, it happened to the United States. She didn't say that. She said, it did happen in a third world country. And she said, we wouldn't be okay with that. And then she said, this is the United States of America. So you're kind of naturally the brain builds a bridge between those things. And she said, and it's past time we start acting like it. President Biden's border crisis is a disgrace. So naturally, you sort of conflate all of those things. So it was Clinton-esque in its crafting. And it naturally, but they actually stand by that.
You could say your brain made the bridge. She made the bridge, and there's a little hole in it, so she reaches her hand to pull you across so you don't trip and to be sure you make it to the other side and vote for a sexual predator. I there's no forgiving it in my mind.
She was said to be on the short list for vice presidential candidates, that Trump is looking to have a woman on the ticket. And I think that because Trump is so interested in star power and celebrity, and she became a laughingstock, I don't think that Trump was going to choose her now. He might have if she had done a really bang up job. But she came off as kind of goofy. You know, the extra emoting, and I mean, she's almost in tears at one point. It's just like, it just wasn't a solid performance. And people say that she's actually a very smart, capable senator who has gone to the dark side in order to curry favor with Trump, which makes her like just about every other Republican in the country.
Yeah.
Makes her a lot like Elise Stefanik of New York, who is also supposed to be on the short list, and Carrie Lake of Arizona.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure who else is on that list of possible Vice President.
I think Carrie Lake was always on that side, but she sure does double down.
She may have cost herself a vice presidential selection with this.
Well, not according to one Indiana columnist, John Cass, who said about her performance, a star is born. About that, she said, to deliver a speech directly to a camera, I've never done that. You give speeches to groups, conventions, things like that. So that's a very different thing, to be looking directly into the camera. A lot of people thought it was taped. No, it was live. She said, my crime was putting too much passion into issues that I genuinely care about, and they slaughtered me across the airwaves. Kate Middleton saved me with her Photoshop.
There's putting the spin on it.
It's a very difficult challenge to give that response speech. And I think that the most effective ones have been pretty mediocre anyway. The one that I remember was when Christy Todd Whitman gave the Republican response, may have been even to Clinton. It's been a long time ago, but she did it in her own state house. And she had sort of a mini State of the Union scene where she was speaking to a bipartisan group of legislators from a dais like the one that they have in the Capitol. And that was relatively effective, as it sort of matched the stagecraft of the original State of the Union. The other ones where you've got, you know, Marco Rubio getting a sip of water during his speech,
or
people awkwardly perched places. You know, I think the way you do it is you just put someone in an office setting, like the Oval Office speeches, and you just have them give a short response. One criticism I had was that she talked about how Biden was doddering and weak. I can't remember the exact adjectives that she used, but she was assuming that he was going to come off weak,
right,
and feeble,
right.
And so the question that my first thought was like, she didn't even watch that speech. This is all canned, which I guess I shouldn't be surprised. They can't wait till he finishes to write the speech. But every single line, they have to go over and go, well, wait a minute, he didn't come off as dithering.
Yeah, they could have fixed it.
And they didn't, which made you think that maybe it was taped.
Yeah, I know. But the argument against it being taped, and she's since said that it was live, is that if that was taped, they would have said, cut, do it over.
Don't you think she rehearsed it and did exactly what she intended and what she was coached to do?
I think when that light comes on, you lose your breath. You know, she was trying too hard.
Somebody, a friend of ours who's some evangelical background, says if you're from these evangelical Southern roots, you recognize that voice. She called it a fundy voice, like fundamental, that women use to show their subservience. They whisper and they know their place. And
wow.
So there's some people who interpret it. I'd never heard that anywhere else, but I'm not part of that circle, so I don't know. But I will say also that I have a small number of people in my Facebook feed who are not in my bubble, and their running commentary was just what she said. Oh, he's awful. Look at how old he is. He can't put two words together. Oh, he's going to fall over any minute. That was what people on the right saw.
Well, maybe then her performance doesn't hurt the Republicans, and his performance doesn't help the Democrats so much, because they weren't going to vote for Donald Trump anyway. I wonder, like, if you were scoring this, though, the two speeches, what was the number that was like 39%? Maybe that was his approval numbers. But
yeah, that's his general approval number.
It's like 39%, right?
Nate Silver made the point. I went back and looked, Eric. It's a snap poll that CNN does right after these speeches. And it doesn't say precisely how they do the snap poll, but they do it right afterwards. He got a 65% positive number, but that is still the lowest ever since 1998. If Biden is going to win re-election, it's got to be on the basis of what he does, not
how he says what he says.
Well, he's been doing a good job.
About his record. He's been doing a tremendous job. He's passed more progressive legislation, some will say, than any present day president, maybe since Johnson. That might be a slight exaggeration, but he's gotten, you know, the biggest gun reform law since Clinton, which is quite a long time ago now. He's forgiven $130 billion in student loans. He's lowering the price of drugs if the GOP doesn't stop him. He's climate change reform, infrastructure that Republicans are claiming credit for in their own home districts, even though they voted against
Marge, I think some of that stuff is good for him and some of that stuff is bad for him, too. To champion that he was able to eliminate some student loans, not nearly as many as he wanted to or by as much, but I guess that's good for the people that got their loans forgiven. Some of them may be Republicans, but I'm not sure that that's going to translate to votes. The word progressive, you said, the most progressive legislation since Johnson, I think that's part of the problem. If it's too progressive, then maybe he doesn't win those swing voters, those people who don't think we can afford it.
And I give a lot of deference to John's views on this because he hears every day on his radio show from middle America. I mean, that's the WGN audience. And they're going to tell him what they're concerned about. And I know from what I hear from readers that immigration and inflation are two anvils around Biden's neck. And I don't, crime maybe, although the crime statistics are, they are pretty darn good right now. The energy statistics are really good. The inflation number is low, but you're starting from a period of higher inflation. So everybody looks at their grocery bill now and 4 years ago and says, oh, my God, it's so much more. There's no way to get around that unless you have deflation, which is a problem for the economy also. So, you know, people are disgruntled. But I think when you start peeling back what they're disgruntled about, and you know, the economy is doing well, aside from inflation. It's doing well. Employment numbers are good. The stock market is hitting record levels. And I'm trying to understand a little bit more about why people are so unhappy with Joe Biden as president, like what they think needs to change and how they think Donald Trump's going to change it. Because Donald Trump was essentially a failure as a president. He was able to appoint three Supreme Court justices, and that really helped his political base. He gave a huge tax cut to the wealthy, but he never got rid of Obamacare or replaced it with some big, beautiful medical healthcare plan that he promised to. He didn't build more than a little bit of the wall that he kept saying Mexico was going to pay for. What did Donald Trump do as president? And what do people think he's going to do when he's reelected? And those are the kind of questions that I think you really have to hammer on as you get closer to this election, which is...
And I don't think you should ever get to say that I appointed Supreme Court justices is an accomplishment. That's perfect attendance. Whoever the president was going to get to appoint those. And but for Mitch McConnell, it would have been two.
He didn't just appoint three. He appointed the justices to eradicate Roe v. Wade and the protections that women have had for 50 years across this country.
Absolutely.
What he did.
I'm trying to look at it from the point of view of people who are saying they're dissatisfied with Joe Biden as president. You have whatever the percentage is, 60 to 40%, however many people are saying they think he's doing a bad job. And they're not happy with his performance. What do they think that he could have or should have done differently? Now, I think there's some quibbles about immigration, for sure. I know there's a faction of people who are really upset about student loan forgiveness. There are quibbles around the edges. But then you have to compare that to what you could expect from Donald Trump and what he did. You have two men who have 4 years each of a record as president. What did they do in their 4 years? And what do you think they're going to do in the next 4 years if they're elected? Those are the kind of questions you need to ask, not like, you know, is Joe Biden able to walk smoothly like a young man?
Don't you think that's a failure of the media right now, Eric? Don't you think that that's what we're not doing? We're talking about who's winning in the horse race. We're not talking enough about the horses. I think that's the second time I've used that expression on this podcast. But
no,
I think that's true.
I think so. And, Mark Jacob, who's occasionally on this panel, has just been beating the drum over and over about media responsibility, that we need to pull the fire alarm.
Getting back to Katie Britt, I mean, obviously she came off as completely crazy, but people who don't want Trump to be president, focusing on that, you know, going forward, focusing on that is just shooting fish in a barrel sort of thing. One of her main points was the immigration problem. And that is a real issue. It's like Biden's age. People who don't want Trump to be president can't pretend that it's not real and an issue that's just being fabricated. His administration didn't want to admit that until pretty recently. They have to do more in the campaign than just complain about the Republicans not accepting that compromise bill. She did make the point that Biden did execute, you know, executive orders that did create more of a rush to the border. If they want to win, I'm just saying, they can't just focus on Katie Britt's making up a fake problem, because there is a real problem.
And you don't think there's much traction to the fact that the Republicans would not sign that border bill?
I dispute the premise. Republicans have told us, Fox News tells us this is a big problem. Texas tells us it's a problem because they don't want to deal with it. There's a core of racism there that you can't deny. Meanwhile, first of all, Katie Britt, you're letting off the hook pretty fast. She's one of the negotiators of the bill, and then she voted against it because Trump told her to. So I think she's discredited entirely on that issue. Secondly, the Congressional Budget Office report got very little attention, but came out a couple weeks ago and said that immigration is good. The surge in immigration is specifically good. It'll boost the economy $7 trillion over the next 10 years because it's providing the labor force that we need. We don't have the workers. We don't have school bus drivers in Chicago. We don't have a staff for service industries, people to flip burgers, the things that people who are born in this country don't seem to want to do. Immigrants do and can and will provide this workforce that is part of what's hurting the economy.
With a lower attended crime rate, I might add. Northwestern University professors this week came out with a study that said that, in fact, they commit crime at a lower rate than American citizens.
And that's not the first study to show that. There have been many over time to show that. And you look at mass shootings. It's very rare. I think only that one in California was somebody who was an immigrant.
Well, I'm definitely not letting Katie Britt off the hook, but I do think it's a big mistake for the Democrats to campaign on. There is no problem at the border. There is no problem with illegal immigration. If we just say it's not a problem, that's not going to win over people who right now are leaning towards Trump.
Again, we have to be careful with the terminology, though. I don't think illegal immigration is at an all-time high. Asylum seekers are. In fact, you see statistics that under Biden, there have been more arrests at the border than there were under Trump. Illegal immigration is not. They're not flooding across the borders, as Republicans would tell you.
Oh,
there is a rush for asylum seeking.
But the whole claim for asylum system is broken, Marge.
Because Republicans voted against
asylum,
more money.
Of course, we all feel for them. But the fact is, we can't let everybody from South and Central America come here claiming asylum in order to get better paying jobs, as much as we would all like that. And this is the image that Republicans are trying to put out there of Democrats, that is what Democrats would like to do.
Why Biden wanted more money for the judicial system so we could process more quickly. And the Republicans took it out of the bill.
Well, are you saying to process them more quickly so that we are just definitely letting everyone who claims asylum have it?
They're screened.
That we're sending many of them back.
They're screened, and we don't have enough screeners, so there's a backlog. They go to court.
Oh,
we don't have enough judges or enough staff, enough courtrooms, and Biden is trying to expand and expedite the process, so those who do not qualify will be sent home.
I just doubt that is something that's going to persuade people who are really concerned about this.
When you watch TV and you see the migrants coming across the border illegally or legally seeking asylum, you don't see that distinction made, because maybe it's not known, but I don't see that conversation being had on TV about any of these things. I don't read a lot about that distinction. I think we would behoove us all to pay a little attention to that. I won't read all of the Bring Chicago Home referendum, We don't have time. The idea is, should we raise the title transfer fee on expensive properties and lower it on less expensive properties so as to generate revenue to house and care for the homeless? That's Bring Chicago Home, and we've talked about it a lot on this podcast. But many people will see for the first time the referendum in the voting booth. And it doesn't say, are you for or against Bring Chicago Home? It says in part, I'll read it real fast just to give you the idea. Shall the city of Chicago impose a real estate transfer tax decrease of 20% to establish a new transfer tax rate of $3 for every $500 of the transfer price or fraction thereof for that part of the transfer price under $4 million to be paid by the buyer of the real estate transferred unless the buyer is exempt from the tax solely by the operation of state law, in which case the tax is to be paid by the seller, and a real estate transfer tax, and then it goes on. There's four paragraphs like that. And at the end, you have to vote yes or no. I got to tell you guys, there's a few things that bother me about this. One is just the ridiculous wording of it, legal as it is. I would also mention that the Supreme Court, as of just about an hour ago, said here in Illinois that the vote on this issue will count. If it's passed by referendum, then it'll go to the Chicago City Council. I'm not sure what the City Council will do, but we're on the precipice now of really radically changing the nature of that title transfer, and who knows what the economic consequences are to the city. And the CTU is trying to get students out of school to go vote.
The event will go forward without Bring Chicago Home as a sponsor.
So are the students still going to be able to go? Are they getting out of school to go? Would they be able to vote on this referendum then?
There is an excellent question in my mind about why the teachers' union is sponsoring this rather than Chicago Public Schools. The union is a political partisan organization. They bankrolled Mayor Johnson's campaign. They've put, I think, $400,000 into the Bring Chicago Home campaign. They are definitely on a side there. They sent out an email to teachers on Monday urging them to recruit students to this rally on Friday morning at CTU headquarters, the union headquarters, and they listed La Casa Norte and Bring Chicago Home as partners in the event. And then when this became a story, you saw Stacey Davis Gates, the union president, go on the Ben Jarofsky show, the podcast from the Reader, and just attack the Illinois Policy Institute because it was our friend Austin Berg, usual panelist on this program, who was the one who was I guess I don't know if he found this out, if it's leaked to him, this email he was tweeting out about it and promoting it as a story. And so she, instead of really defending what was going on, Stacey Davis Gates just spent a whole bunch of time attacking the Illinois Policy Institute. It's a libertarian conservative think tank. And not really getting into this fact that Bring Chicago Home was a sponsor. And she was saying, oh, it's nonpartisan. It's just an educational field trip. The students would be encouraged to vote one way or the other. Then the union puts out a statement saying the statement was very curious. It said Bring Chicago Home is not a partner or sponsor of this event and is not on the agenda, which is sort of gaslighting us because they were. And if you wanted to say they are no longer part of the event or we've changed the event, but to say that they're not part of the event when they clearly were, the email from Jackson Potter to all the teachers, high school teachers in the city, was very clear that Bring Chicago Home was a partner in this event. And that's just inappropriate. And I think no matter how you feel about the referendum, you've got to say, like, it ain't right for the union to be doing this. And we'd be howling if this were like, If the Illinois Policy Institute were to say have a rally and try to get students out of to skip school and come down to the Illinois Policy Institute headquarters and then head over to the polls, we would say that's inappropriate. Like, don't haul kids out of school for a private institution, which is what the Chicago Teachers Union is, to go and gin up the vote for anything. It's just like that relationship between students and teachers and the union is inappropriate, in my opinion.
It's pretty amazing. Austin really he was incredulous this week in asking how this is even legal. How is this allowed to happen? And that email that you mentioned includes encouraging the teachers to get involved. The only thing your school needs to do is provide the students. Organize a group of voting age students to attend the event. It's pretty square what they were up to there.
I hadn't even really thought about it in terms of why the CTU can do this. I had been thinking about it in terms of it's wrong for them to be doing something in conjunction with the activist groups that are promoting the tax referendum, promoting anything. It should be something completely neutral. But if the CTU can do it, which is a private and political group, I mean, they themselves acknowledge that they are now a political party, a political machine, really. If it's okay for them to send emails to all the Chicago school principals promoting their own little field trip, why can't just anybody do that?
What's really a shame is Chicago Votes is a partner in this project. Chicago Votes is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, about youth voter registration and engagement. They put out videos. What is an alderman? How do you do a witness slip if you want to support something in Springfield? They do a lot of great voter education. I wish they had partnered with CPS and done it as an education component, and that would have felt very appropriate and positive. And in fact, despite the backlash now, I hope CPS officials think about this in the future. We want civic training for our youth, and I don't think there's that much of it in the public school curriculum, and it would be useful and positive for our city and country's future if there was more.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That would make total sense.
Yeah, it makes sense to get young people excited about government and politics and voting, because it's their world that these people are going to be shaping, that the elected officials, these referenda, that's their world. They're going to be living in it a lot longer than the people on this panel are going to be living in it. And they need to get excited about voting and understand the process. And Chicago Votes, I actually went on their website because I wanted to see if they were involved in any partisan way on the referendum, and they're not. They're very straightforward information they provided. La Casa Norte, which is another sponsor, they're squarely behind the referendum. In fact, just yesterday, their director had an op-ed in the Sun-Times explaining why the referendum was such a good idea, which is fine, but you can't have La Casa Norte and Bring Chicago Home as partners in this event with the union, which has given all this money to this effort, and then say, oh, no, we're just trying to get people to vote. We're not going to try to sway them one way or the other. I don't think anybody believed that. And again, it's like this involvement of a union, a political entity, a private political entity, yanking kids out of school, essentially, for their own purposes. It just doesn't pass the smell test at all. And I think that the idea that that CPS ought to say, well, let's us do this next time, is a great idea. It's a fabulous idea. And pulling students out of school for a morning or a day to find out all about how their city works and how elections work and how you vote and all that, that's great.
Let's just kind of reverse engineer it. So say we just said we were going to pull all the kids that can vote out of the classes that day, put them on buses, or set up an early voting booth. That's not a bad idea.
You would want to integrate that into a voter education plan. You'd want to teach them how to research the issues, meet the candidate sites. There are a lot of nonpartisan places. Find the questionnaires they fill out for the Trib and the Sun-Times and learn about the candidates. Then we will take you to vote when you are educated.
All right, so we'll make it easy for the kids to vote. Think of all those kids that would be able to vote. That would be a great thing. Then we're going to educate them. Say there was a referendum issue about climate change or something about guns or right to life issues. Would you then have a pro and a con on these issues, Marge?
Or you would choose students to have a debate and research, and you take the pro and Susie will take the con, and let's hear them present what they've learned.
See, on climate change, I don't think there's two sides to that. So this is how it gets
apparently
tricky.
There are.
I know, but I mean, I don't think it would be helpful to the kids to pollute their minds with the disinformation that is out there about climate change. And anything on the other side of the climate change issue, to me, feels like misinformation.
Well, it could be helpful for them to research and find out it's not true. They have to evaluate the points of view, you know.
But we're not against...
I mean, that's a complete hypothetical, but if there was a specific climate change policy on the ballot, any specific policy can be debated as to whether it's the best policy.
I'm glad I'm not a social studies teacher, because I think I'd get in trouble for saying, all right, kids, there's this thing about climate change in Chicago and all the garbage trucks are going to be electric. And that's probably a good thing because the gas trucks contribute to the pollution and the earth's heating up. So really, the best thing for the environment is the electric garbage trucks. I'm sure when that got home, I would be in trouble.
That's the point about education, is to teach critical thinking, to teach students how to hear the good, the bad, and the ugly,
yeah,
and figure out how to form their judgments based fact-based research. That would be the best education policy we could have in this country right now. It's urgently needed. There's an Illinois literacy bill that requires media literacy training, for example, to teach kids how to take what they read. Just because it's in the media doesn't mean it's true. And that kind of training, we need more and more of that.
Do they do that? Are they taught that? There's a curriculum for that in our high schools?
There, I think it's a law passed 2 years ago, maybe, and there is a coalition that's headed by someone, co-chaired at least by somebody at Northwestern Medill. Michael Spikes is his name. And there are people all around the state who are developing curriculum and information to provide teachers. How far along it is, I'm not certain. But yeah, media literacy is a key component that this country desperately needs.
Kate Middleton, the Princess of Wales, posted a family photo for Mother's Day in England. The picture was altered, maybe with Photoshop. She has since apologized. And this news broke the internet this week. My first take on this was that everyone does this. A lot of people do. What's the harm or crime here? In fact, the personal technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal today wrote that this is hardly new. A portrait of Abraham Lincoln from 1852 is actually his head superimposed on someone else's body. One expert, she quotes, says that Middleton had the right to edit the photo, but it should not have been released as an official photo by the royal family. Who you are and how it's used, maybe to disguise the effects of a recent illness, matters. But the last of that column goes like this. She said, perhaps even we non-royals should think before applying face slimming, skin smoothing, eyelash extending effects, even if it is just something that we are sharing with friends. We might be contributing to a culture of unrealistic standards. Our tech, she writes, tells us that the perfect shot is altered so everyone and everything looks perfect. But maybe the best picture is the one that evokes a memory, a real one that no amount of Photoshop magic can conjure. I thought that was pretty well put. Erica, I haven't heard from you in a while.
Well, first of all, I have to admit that I use the Touch Up My Appearance tab on Zoom. So,
and you do look terrific, I might add.
I look. I'm educating you guys because, yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that existed. I'm looking for it now.
I was impressed that people picked up that it was a Photoshopped image. I thought that was interesting. And there's all kinds of questions about whether we should really care that much about what this outmoded family, these inbred people who have these ceremonial positions over in Great Britain, what it is that they do all the time. Like, does it really matter to any of us, or why should it matter to any of us? But there is this whole idea that as AI gets better and better, it's going to be harder and harder to tell. Now, I guess the photo editing that was done on this particular picture was clumsy enough that it didn't take a lot of effort to figure out that it was faked. But you can imagine that someone with more skills could have done something much more difficult to detect, and that's frightening. The whole thing of deep fakes they can do voice imitations, they can do videos, they could have made it look like she was in a porn video, given the technology they have now, and all that stuff. I mean, as I said before on this podcast, the ability to tell what's true from what's false is just completely integral to democracy itself. To a functioning society. If you can't tell truth from a lie, there's no way to discern what's right and what's true and what's false. Then we have no hope of making intelligent decisions or governing ourselves in a sense.
Oh, maybe it's a slippery slope, but and that's well put, Eric. But that's not exactly what I was asking about that photograph. Did you think that there was any harm done? I think she has a right to doctor a picture to make her family look better and put it out for Mother's Day. And all the scrutiny about where she was or does she have a medical situation or all the other rumors out there, I don't think she has to respond to. Even as a royal, I think she's still a person.
doesn't have to respond to it. I think what she should have done, or what Buckingham Palace should have done, is sent out a photographer to take a real photo, and or let a wire service photographer come out and take a real photo. If there's nothing to hide, there's no real problem, just come out sort of and restage that photo or a different photo and put that story to bed. I don't think we'd be talking about it if it was discovered that, yeah, she was just screwing around with Photoshop and, you know, no big deal. But there's a sense that is out there that she's hiding something really major.
Well, what if she's just being vain? I mean, it's ironic that most people doctor their photos to look like she actually does. But what if she was doing it just to make them look like, for instance, maybe that's not her most recent face. That's from a Vogue cover 8 years ago. So it sure looks like that's what happened here. But if she's doing it just to look better.
I'm fine with it because I don't really care what she does.
Yes, I know.
Do we actually think that Kate Middleton did this? Because as a Crown watcher also, my understanding was that nothing like this would get out without going through the palace press office.
Well, they released it. The right? palace released it.
Okay.
As a photo that she provided. So there's Crown Watchers. There's a thing, maybe she wouldn't allow them to send a photographer, Eric, for whatever reason. The gossip now is that she's in seclusion because her husband's having an affair. I don't know about that.
Who knows what her motivation was? Maybe there is the affair thing going on. Maybe she's still recuperating or, in fact, is very ill from whatever she had surgery for. It was foolish. It was foolish for her or the palace to do this and send it out because there was no way even the best photoshopped thing would not have been caught because they know they're under that kind of microscope. So, I don't think it was immoral or evil. It was just foolish.
I think it was stupid, just foolish. I think that's a really good word to describe what happened here. You know, it's not like she's the defense secretary and we have a chain of command issue and we need to make sure that the right person is in the right place and available at all times. Sometimes people just don't want to tell you everything that you may want to know. And maybe it was foolish to even think that she should put out a picture for Mother's Day. She said she likes to fool around with photoshopping or editing the photographs. I don't think that there's should be any more criticism of this than that. So she got caught altering the photograph and didn't do a very good job of it. That's the end of it.
There was just a thing in the New York Times, I want to say, about Pamela Anderson coming out with a new line of clothes and how apparently she has been part of this no makeup movement for a while, which I did not know. I think of Alicia Keys in that whole movement, but I guess Pamela Anderson too. That is certainly a healthier way to go than this constant photoshopping. I remember when my kids were teenagers and the Kardashian thing was such a juggernaut, and even the younger Kardashians were all over the place with their photoshopped images of themselves. And that, we all know, that is a huge mental illness problem for teenage girls, seeing these images and thinking that that's actual reality.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. If the Alicia Keys and Pamela Andersons of the world could be the ones lighting the way instead, how great would that be?
If there's any fault, it's the palace for releasing a photo that they did not find out its genesis and did not look very closely at it, because you didn't have to look too closely at all. But I think you're right, John. There's the deeper problem, or as Eric said, you know, where are we going with deep fakes? There is a bill in Springfield right now that would make it illegal to use deep fakes in campaign materials. And I'm hoping that passes. In general, they don't like to pass election-related bills in an election season, but this one would seem to be worthwhile, I would say. Representative Abdel Nasser Rashid and Maurice West out of Rockford, who's the head of the Elections Committee, and they're trying to get this through. And I would hope that it does, with some repercussions for anyone who puts that out in campaign materials right now.
If that photoshopping contributes to esteem issues in teenagers, there is a long article that just dropped in The Atlantic, and it goes into great detail about how problematic this is for young people in this country, about living on their phones, looking at things, just being exposed to so much anxiety. And boy, the statistics are just alarming. Let's leave it at that and go to one more thing. Looks like Chicago is back in the hunt for the Bears downtown, right? $2 billion maybe from the team.
I think the Michael Reese site, which is a little bit further south and across the Lakeshore Drive, would be a much better spot for the Bears. I'm really unhappy. Soldier Field was renovated in the early part of this century. It reopened in September of 2003. 21 years ago, it reopened. The new Sox Park was renovated in 2001. It was opened in 1991. We still owe money on these projects. These are not old, dilapidated stadiums the way, you know, old Comiskey Park was and the way old Soldier Field were. These are fairly modern, fairly new stadiums, just not as new and modern as they would now like them to be. And this failure of foresight by the Bears and by the White Sox, now we're going to be asked to pay for. And I think that the level of skepticism and scrutiny that needs to be applied to these applications for our money to be used in this way, it's a very high threshold that you want to know that this is really going to pay off. And I haven't seen all that. The Sun-Times had a pretty good editorial today saying there are so many unanswered questions about this sort of surprise move. The Bears spent $200 million to buy Arlington Park. And now they're just going to walk away from it? Is that what we're supposed to know? Because
well, they can
not
sell it. I mean, they can get their money back, some of their money back.
I don't know of what they can. Yeah, maybe they will. We'll see. But the idea as a Chicago taxpayer, I'm very skeptical to angry about them coming back with their hat in their hand.
We still owe on those two sites. We owe about $50 million on the current Sox Park and anywhere from $400 to $640 million, depending on how long, if we let it run to its term, on the last Soldier Field renovations. It only cost $400 million in the first place. So when they talk about extending debt for another 10 years, that's what it means. It means hundreds of millions of dollars more for the taxpayers. I was interested in what Mayor Johnson said. The headline was, lays out what he would need from a Bears deal. And what he said was public benefit. What? What is the public benefit? Are we getting enough revenue? Are we going to own the entertainment district that they're talking about? Are we going to pay all the infrastructure and they get all the revenue? Apparently, there's a report also that says the Bears would get naming rights, which they can't have on Soldier Field. Are we going to get a cut of that? We're going to give them the revenue? What public benefit? That's a generic term that tells me nothing. It does not make him sound like a very stern negotiator on our behalf.
I don't know if the Bears are serious about this or if they're just using us to negotiate with Arlington Heights. It's very hard to see how they get the entertainment district that they want associated with the stadium if they do it in this parking lot area. Although I don't want to put anything past them. If it's publicly owned, maybe somehow they can do it anyway. But all the stadiums these days are doing these entertainment districts. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to imagine that they want to give that up. So I could see this being a negotiating ploy. I saw the mayor of Arlington Heights on TV saying, well, you know, now that we see what we're up against, you know, believe me, we're getting right back in there and we're going to be dealing with the Bears.
Yeah, there's no way they can have that entertainment district on the lakefront. The lakefront protection ordinance will not allow for that. It may not even allow for them to build a new stadium on the parking lot area. That's why the Michael Reese site certainly makes a lot more sense. And you would think that if
Arlington Heights makes more sense. I mean, just
yeah, it does. It makes
you
sense.
You know though? I mean, it's so crazy the way we're even discussing the possibility of building a dome stadium on the lakefront. But that's how tangled this kind of stuff can be. They came close to agreeing to tearing down McCormick Place and putting like the Lucas Museum there instead. They were talking about that. That was a possibility. I'm just saying, I would not be shocked if the Bears are thinking, well, you know, if we say we're going to take down everything but the Soldier Field columns, and then we have the Dome Stadium, then what we do is we take down McCormick Place, and we have our little entertainment district over there, but it'll be publicly owned. We'll just be renting it, and the public can come. So what a great public benefit. You know, the Obama Foundation library getting into Jackson Park, one of the worst things about that is that it just kind of continues to lower the barrier to giving away parkland.
I think that's exactly the kind of cute way they're trying to thread the needle. Well, you can't have private. Well, it can be publicly owned. We'll just rent it for $50 a year or whatever. I hate to say a dollar, but that's probably what it would be. But yes, I think you're exactly right, Kate. They're trying to be that cute, and they're succeeding in getting the mayor to try to govern by bright, shiny object. Just because they said they want this doesn't mean that's our priority right now.
Well, I don't think that Mayor Johnson or any mayor would want to be the mayor that lost the Bears, quote unquote, lost the Bears to the suburbs or lost the White Sox in Nashville. It's something that would probably not play well. Although I got to say, I don't believe they put out some polls. The people who are behind us put out some polls saying that Chicagoans are really enthusiastic about this. I think it really, really depends on how you ask that question and what kind of factors you put into it. Like, hey, you want a new stadium? Sure. We don't want a new stadium. Yeah, use other people's tax money. Sure, why not? But when you get down to all the details, which is, again, what the Sun-Times today was urging people to do, it becomes a little much less clear. I would be really curious how the public actually thinks about this.
Well, talk about media responsibility. That poll was reported, even though it was a sample size of only 450 people, and they refused to release the question. So you don't know what they were asked. I don't think the media should have said anything more than they're referencing a dubious poll without providing the details. It's like you protect the name of victims. You should have protected the results of the poll because it was not a legitimate poll by media standards. Why would they even give those percentages of people's approval of the Bears' proposal when we don't know what they were asked?
Yeah.
Maybe if we should not have covered that way.
What if there was a completely legitimate poll and a majority of people would like to have the lakefront taken up by a dome stadium? Does that automatically mean that it should happen?
Well, I wouldn't speculate on how such a poll would turn out because people, I'm hearing and media and in my own examples, a lot of anger about paying more money for these privately owned teams. And look, Reinsdorf is clear. His son, he says, when he dies, and he's in his late 80s, too old to be president, as I think I said before, he said that his family doesn't want to keep the Sox. They're going to sell the Sox.
Yep.
So now we're going to put money into a fancy new stadium that enhances the value of the team he is about to sell. Why the heck would we do that?
No, but if we do that, then they'll stay, right, Marge? Isn't that the idea? Do it, so then his sons won't sell it. They'll have this beautiful new stadium.
They're not promising that. He says his sons want to sell it. He's not saying give him this new stadium and we'll sign an agreement that in perpetuity will stay in Chicago. I haven't heard any of that promise.
That's it for today.
I want to show you guys something here. This is me fully touched up. Now watch this. Watch this. When it goes like this, that's not touched up at all.
Wait, show me the difference again. Do it again.
This is not touched up here. And now when I touch it up, a lot of the wrinkles go away.
Your hair looks better. Looks wavier.
I don't see the difference.
Here.
Maybe
I'm not seeing.
I got bad news for you. You don't look a lot better.
Eyes. Look at the bags under my eyes and the wrinkles in my forehead. And now you just go like this and they kind of all go away.
By the way, we got this note. It says, I love the Mincing Rascals. I usually don't agree with you guys, but the conversations are great and shows everyone's point of view. I've changed my opinion many times after I hear a different but compelling point of view. We heard some of those today. Thank you, Gary, for sending that email in. And you can email me, John Williams, at WGNradio.com. That's our pod this week. Marge and Kate and Eric, thank you. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
All right, you should take out that business where I'm showing you. It's not going to be good radio. But
well, I think it is.
Look at this. Anyway, all right. See you guys soon. Thanks.
Mwah. All right. Much fun.
A lot of fun.
Oh, with those happy Canadians, Marge.
Thanks. Sorry if you went on. Did I go on and on with my little intro? I never know how to say who I am. I don't know.
Austin would never mention his book. I go, Austin, sell some books.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for having us.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.